such a time as this. You know, I think it is well for us to begin this morning in Revelation 4, verses 6 and 7. Go back to the foundations of what our mission is, what it is that we are called for, we called to do. There's so much information that those of us who have been here all week have been gleaning from the different speakers. And there's so many things that are going on. But we need to keep a very clear focus, I think, and continue to dig deeper, not just in terms of what's going on, but deeper in the Scriptures. Amen? Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead. Yes, this is a different translation. I like it. It's a new one. I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water." Well, this is my third presentation this week. The first one, we looked at the United States and the transformation from our lamb-like character to speaking as a dragon. And the second one, we looked at the issue of marriage, and today we're going to look at the issue of money and the economy. But there really is at least one common theme that I think runs through all of these topics, which I'll try to pull together here this morning. And we find it right here in Revelation, first angel's message. The real issue is the identity and the authority and the character of our Creator. Isn't that right? That's the real issue. The United States, when we were founded, established principles of civil and religious freedom that in the annals of human history were a unique reflection of the character of the Lamb. Remarkable, isn't it? All nations in prophecy are beasts. But there was something unique in the American spirit, character, and the principles of our nation. Something that we ought to cherish, that we ought to fight for, that we should not simply allow to dissipate and to be eroded without protest. Amen? We should stand up for what America truly is supposed to be, a reflection of the character. Now, yesterday, many were very complimentary about our discussion of marriage, but I have a confession to make. I forgot my most important message point. Genesis 1:27. I'm not going to try it from memory. I don't know about you. You might be real sharp early in the morning. I'm less confident in just how good awake I am. Genesis 1:27. I don't hear pages rustling. Are you really coming to a prophecy seminar without Bibles in hand? I hope not. And my Bible's a new one, so it takes me longer to flip the pages and get there. Oh, you've got it on. You know, I don't like that, Dick. All these digital, my kids want to come to worship with their, you know, iPhones. I'm like, no, bring a Bible to worship, crying out loud. I don't want to, you're going to be texting your friends pretending to read the Bible. Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created. There's so much confusion about the question of marriage and whether Christians should really do anything about the issue of same-sex marriage. And I think in our sort of tolerant, permissive social attitudes, even Adventists tend to say, well, you know, what two gay people do in the privacy of their own home, it doesn't really affect me. It's not a problem. Why should I care if they want to get married? What we need to understand is the deeper spiritual issue in the conflict over marriage. And I'm gonna give you the caveat first that I didn't give yesterday. Who did Jesus die for? Did he die for the elect? For a few of us? For Seventh-day Adventists or those who will join our church? You know, when I go to some interfaith meetings, I'll hear a Baptist or a Methodist tell the joke. You know, the punchline is usually something like, shh, they think they're the only ones in heaven. And I've often thought, you know, it's nice that they can tell those jokes on themselves. I'm not sure we Adventists have enough of a sense of humor to tell that joke on ourselves. Because, of course, we've had that same attitude at times. Now, it's very critically important that we understand the doctrine of universal atonement. That we understand that Christ died to save everyone. And he has already paid the price for the salvation of every person. Now, am I preaching universalism? Am I saying that everyone will be saved? Of course not. That's not the point. By contrast, the mark of the beast would be marvelously doctrinally supported, logically anyway, by the doctrine of limited atonement that was held by John Calvin and has become increasingly popular today. The doctrine of limited atonement that Calvin espoused says, we're the elect, we know God's will, God has chosen us, and we have every right and responsibility to rule in God's name. And you guys, you were born to be chaff for the fire. Your destiny is to burn forever and ever. You don't know God. You can never know God. You were not born or chosen to know God. You were born destined to burn, and you don't count. Now, in that equation, eventually, it would, if I want to look in my crystal ball and speculate, but it would certainly make sense for Seventh-day Adventists to be numbered with the chaff rather than with the chosen. So this issue is really, really important that we understand the gospel that Christ died for everyone. Now, when Jesus was on earth, who did he hang with? Sinners. Oh my! He ate and drank with sinners. There is probably no class in America today who is more derided by Christians, homosexuals. And so I have to wonder if Jesus were here today, if the Pharisees would not be poo-pooing Jesus spending time in the company of gays and deriding him, not just because of the circumstances of his birth, but because of his sinful associations. So I want it to be very clear that in our discussion of marriage, I certainly do not intend any hostility to homosexuals, because, of course, everyone these days who stands up in support of traditional marriage, and why do we even have to put an adjective in front of the word marriage? But everyone who stands up in support of traditional marriage is, by definition, a homophobe. Well, I've coined a new term. Actually, it's not that new, but I wasn't the first one to coin it, but I hadn't heard it before. The term is heterophobe. Those who deride us because of our beliefs as homophobes are heterophobes. We are hated because we believe in heterosexual marriage. So there are heterophobes. Anyway, back to Genesis 1:27, now that I've given my caveat here. The real issue in the battle over marriage is an attack by the enemy on the very image of God. It's really that simple. If you think about what marriage is, in the intimacy that we are privileged to enjoy in wife in the context of marriage, we have a gift from the Creator, an opportunity to understand through that experience something of the reality of the Trinity. If there is any Christian doctrine that is more confusing and more difficult for our brains to wrap around than the doctrine of the Trinity, I don't know what there is. The theologians have been muddling through this one for for hundreds and hundreds of years, certainly. As a doctrine, the Trinity is just very, very difficult. But we have an opportunity to experience the reality that there is intimacy among the three persons of the Godhead. There is unity among three distinct persons of the Godhead. And we get just a glimpse of that in the intimacy that we enjoy in marriage. And in marriage, we reflect the very image of God, as 1:27 says. We were His image, male and female. Men, you were not created in the image of God by yourselves, and neither were you, women. Only together are we really created in God's image. So I think it's really critical that we understand that in these last days, we've expected Satan's attack on the law of God to be an attack on the Sabbath, a memorial of creation. But marriage was also an institution established by God in Eden and also reflects something intensely profound about the character and the nature of the Godhead, of the Creator. Amen? We may not, as a church, have anticipated the attack on marriage, but if we are aware and true to our calling to be repairers of the breach of the spiritual foundations that have been eroded and destroyed over many generations, and our calling is to bring spiritual restoration to all the institutions, then we cannot neglect the institution of marriage. And the last thing that I neglected to say yesterday on this topic is, folks, you know, those of you in California, it's not real hard to go to the voting booth and cast a ballot. That's really not what it means to take a stand in support of, do something significant in support of marriage. Voting is easy. Building effective marriage ministries in our local churches and helping to build strong marriages in our communities and ministering to those who are struggling and providing resources to young couples who don't have the tools. They may have the affection. They may be suited for one another, but they don't have the tools to make it. We need, as a church, to make this a much greater priority in our ministry. It's easy to preach, it's easy to vote, it's much harder to roll up our sleeves and to help build strong marriages in our communities. So we're talking about what I think are the real issues in the first angel's message, the very identity, the authority, and the character of the Creator. And we looked at it as reflected in the erosion of the United States, of the character of the United States becoming an empire and projecting our military force in ways that are dragon-like and eroding our constitutional respect for individual liberties, eroding the separation of powers and consolidating power in an imperial presidency, indulged in by both parties, I might add. We're going to see how that has played true in the monetary crisis. We certainly have an imperial presidency trying to manage the monetary crisis. We can hope that it will be successful. We can even support his goals and his methods. But you have to wonder, when the United States becomes the dominant shareholder in companies like General Motors, this doesn't seem consistent with the American economy and the American government was designed to function. Certainly it's an emergency measure, and we all hope and wish for the best, but let's also keep our eyes open, seeing how unprecedented these things are. So today we look at the economic crisis. We look at the issue of money and the economy in prophecy. I was asked before the meeting this morning, Alan, so you're gonna make everything clear about the economy, right? Sure, I'm going to tell you exactly what's going to happen. I'm going to look into my crystal ball. You know all those Back to the Future movies? Give me tomorrow's Wall Street Journal, and I'll retire today. No, I'm not going to make everything clear. I think one of the reasons that Greg Hamilton wanted me to do this topic is because I come from an old Wall Street family. My grandfather was nicknamed the Baron of Wall Street. He founded a brokerage house. He saw what was coming in 1929. He sold out in the summer, and he took a cruise ship to Europe, and he got out of New York in time for the bloodbath that took place in the fall of 19 and came back some months later. I'm the first in three generations to leave Wall Street. My father wrote what was then a best-selling book on commodities trading. He was early one of the movers and shakers in establishing commodities markets in the United States, and my brother has followed suit, and he used to trade in a seat on the New York Futures Exchange downtown in one of the short buildings, but then after his marriage, he had the luxury of moving uptown and trading in his bathrobe on his computer over Little Park West, over Little Park, across the street from where John Lennon was shot. So when I go to visit, we always visit the memorial there in Central Park, Strawberry Fields Memorial, where they're throwing flowers and somebody's inevitably sitting there playing guitar, playing John Lennon tunes. Anyway, so I'm the first in three generations to leave Wall Street, but, you know, Wall Street really hasn't entirely left my blood. And I've certainly retained a considerable interest in markets and economies and analysis. And I guess, you know, the first caveat that I should give you is there's always been gloom and doomers. And when you see very reputable economic analysis telling you that the sky is falling and what's going to happen and how terrible things are going to get, I have to tell you, you got to put that in context. We have been reading this stuff for 30 years. As long as I've been following markets, there are always those who are prophesying doom. And you have to know, my brother as a trader, something in his character, perhaps, he only trades downticks in the market. He only trades when the market, movements down. He doesn't trade up movements. He makes all his money on down movements. He is a bear through and through. So, I mean, I have lived with the gloom and doomers all my life. Are the gloom and doomers sometimes right? Of course. But I think we need to, start by putting this in perspective. There's an awful lot we don't know about what's going to happen short term in the economy and in the markets. And this is Sabbath school. This is not a lecture on inflation and market analysis and what have you. And so we're not going to go there. But we are going to take a look at the biblical texts that I think are relevant for us to put what's happening with the economic meltdown in some kind of sound spiritual perspective. And I'm going to start maybe in a place that you wouldn't expect me to start. I'm going to start with 2 Peter chapter 3. Turn, if you will, to 2 Peter chapter 3. And I think we've got time this morning. I'm going to read from the beginning of the chapter, although I think the emphasis that I'm going to draw out is from the middle of the chapter. This is now the second letter that I'm writing to you, beloved. In both of them, I'm stirring up your sincere mind by way of reminder that you should remember the predictions of the holy prophets and the commandment of the Lord and Savior through your apostles, knowing this, first of all, that scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing, following their own sinful desires. They will say, "Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things are continuing as they were from the beginning of creation. For they deliberately overlooked this fact that the heavens existed long ago and the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God. And that by means of these, the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. But by the same word, the heavens and earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly. The character, the authority, the identity of God as Creator is the special focus of the cynicism and scoffing of our arrogant, narcissistic generation. Isn't that right? And this is really the focus of the attack. Well, of course there's no judgment. Of course Christ is not coming. Things have always continued this way since the beginning of evolution, zillions of years ago, and it will always continue this way. The issue of creation and our Creator is absolutely critical foundation for our understanding of the judgment and the second coming of Christ. Continuing on. But do not overlook this fact, this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. The Lord is not slow to fulfill His promise, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God? Because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to His promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Why do I start with this verse? Because, folks, we know the ultimate destiny of our homes, of our sports cars, of our retirement accounts, of our designer suits and ties or dresses or whatever your prized possessions are. We know their ultimate destiny. They're all going into the fire. Everything is going to burn. What do I tell my kids? There's only two things that you can bring to heaven. Your character and hopefully some of your relationships, your friends. That's all you can bring with you. The rest of it is going to burn. So when we look at the economy, you know, what we have experienced ought to get our attention and be a reminder of what the future holds. Now, we may not know exactly when, but it is very much a reminder. Now, when we turn to Revelation 13, our Mark of the Beast passage, we talked about Revelation 13 a couple of days ago in context of the United States repudiating its constitutional principles, its Republican and Protestant principles, its lamb-like horns, and speaking as a dragon. When she does that, she enforces worship of the first beast and imposes sanctions, including economic sanctions. We see just a little bit of a hint of a threefold union, if you will. And I'm not talking about the threefold union that we are accustomed to thinking about in Revelation 16, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. That's one threefold union. But here's another threefold union that I think we see developed more fully in Revelation 18, where we're going to spend some time this morning. I'd like to call this threefold union Rome, Washington, D.C., and Wall Street. The threefold union between church and state, and the financial structures of the world. Because in order to have some sort of universal economic sanctions, there's going to be very close collaboration between the financial world and the political world together doing the bidding of the religious world. I think that's the big picture that we see in Revelation 13. And honestly, I for one have not in the past given a great deal of attention to how the financial world will fit into this picture. And I'm not sure that I've heard many others talk much about it as well. But you know, when I went back and restudied Revelation 18 in preparation for this, I've always known that, you know, Revelation 18 tells us about the utter collapse of the economic structures, the collapse of civilization as we know it. And the merchants of the earth stand afar off, weeping and wailing over the fall of Babylon. But I never really saw this as this threefold, that somehow it's not just the union of church and state, but it's the union of church and state and finances as well, that is able to implement the kinds of economic sanctions incident to the mark of the beast. Now, historically, I've often talked about how economic sanctions have become used far more frequently as a primary tool of foreign policy, of international relations. And, you know, I haven't looked at this list in a while, but how many nations can you think of that we either currently have or in the recent memory have imposed some sort of economic restrictions, economic sanctions against? How many nations? North Korea is still current. Cuba, Iran, of course, very severe restrictions in Iran. Other nations? China, not currently. Iraq certainly between the first and second Gulf Wars, Iraq was under all kinds of economic sanctions. In Africa, see, I'm not as familiar with our policies in Africa. I think there are at least, hopefully, there are some in Sudan with what's happening in Sudan with in Darfur and Somalia as well. Anywhere else that you can think of? Libya. Yeah, that's true. When for many years, after the whichever plane they shot down, I get them mixed up, but there were economic sanctions against Libya. I think those were lifted when Gaddafi finally decided to cooperate with us after 9/11 and didn't feel like risking invasion at that point. You know, Bush was such a wild man that he scared the daylights out of the likes of even Colonel Gaddafi. I think you get the point. We have a long history of using economic sanctions in international relations to try to strong-arm countries that are not cooperating with our interests. And by the way, I'm not here to take a political position. The church's role is really not to side with one party or another, or to take overtly political stance about what foreign policies are good and bad, or how we pursue our national interests. We're here to take a biblical view of what's happening. Of course, in an audience this size, I would expect we have a people who are registered voters in either party and no party. So, you know, the church is not to be divided and political. That's not the purpose of this discussion. So let's go ahead and take a look at Revelation 18. Now I see where my note, there was something I was leaving out. Before we go to Revelation 18, there's one other passage that I want to tie in here. And I hope it's one you think about in connection with the economy in the last days. It's one that's very close to my heart as a lawyer who represents workers who have been oppressed and discriminated against. It's found in James chapter 5. So to turn to James chapter 5, because I think there's a couple of lessons that, or a couple of questions that need to come out of our discussion of the economy in the last days. Only one of which is, when will the economic collapse come? The answer to that, which I'll give you because it's so short, while you're turning to James 5, is, according to Revelation 18, it comes after the close of probation, not before. It comes when the plagues are poured out and the whole world comes apart at the seams, not before. Now, does that mean that there won't be economic shocks and turmoil that could contribute to the mark of the beast? There could be. It's just that the Bible doesn't tell us exactly what precipitates the mark of the beast, other than talking about satanic deception. And so I have been very reluctant to speculate about, you know, people are always asking me, well, will there be a nuclear catastrophe, a terrorist attack, some kind of war, some kind of economic collapse? What will precipitate the mark of the beast? Short answer, I don't know. And I dare say I don't think you do either, because I don't think the Bible tells us. And one of my pet peeves, and I've said this many times, is that we spend far too much time as Adventists speculating about things the Bible does not reveal, and far too little time thinking through the implications of what the Bible has revealed, and what are we supposed to do with what we know? What are we supposed to do with what we've been given? You know, one of the things that I think we should do with what we've been given about the economy is invite the communities to come on in and tell them straight, yes, the economy will collapse before Christ comes. Everything's going to be dissolved. But here's how to prepare. We can use this economic crisis as an opportunity to talk straight about our understanding of last day events to people in our community. And I think they will come. It's really not that complicated. James 5. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Now, of course, that's not us. We're not the rich that are being talked about here. And yet, if you think about, statistically speaking, most of us here are probably in the top one-half of 1% of the wealthiest people in the world, statistically speaking. There may be some who are on retirement incomes that take you beyond that top half of 1%, and maybe you're just in the top 5% or something like that. But anyway, come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. So much for my tie collection. I have a weakness for ties. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. This is powerful imagery, isn't it? You have laid up treasure in the last days. There's no question here that this passage is talking about the last days. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. We're going to see that word luxury over and over again in Revelation 18, which is why I wanted to read this first. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. We Christians can be so heavenly minded that we are of little. And sometimes we live in a relatively narrow sort of moral cocoon. And our moral analysis is very much restricted to the things that we experience very immediately. There's certainly a species of Adventist moral analysis, which I always found laughable, even from my first earliest days as a convert and as a baptized member of the church, the sort of moral analysis that measures character in terms of resisting chocolate chip cookies and practicing a vegan diet, which I, by the way, did do for a number of years. That's a fairly shallow approach to moral analysis. Now, if we take a much broader approach, here in the book of James, the rich are accused of oppressing workers. Where was the shirt that you were wearing made? I suspect if we all went back to our rooms and took off our shirts and looked at the label and came back this evening, we'd find that many of us are wearing shirts made in China, because an awful lot of our clothing industry has been sent over to China. In a recent year that I was able to find statistics, a factory worker in the United States would cost a company about $21 an hour. A similar factory worker, average of urban and rural suburban in China, would cost 61 cents an hour. When we think about making moral choices and living luxuriously and the rich being accused in the Bible of oppressing workers, I think we have to think about the morality of our patterns of consumption and whether we ought to, how many shirts made in China do we really need to keep consuming when we buy them cheaply by people who were paid 61 cents an hour on average. So it's a little more than that. In the cities, they make a little over a dollar an hour, and in the rural sections, it's more like 42 cents an hour. So I think these are issues that raise moral issues for those of us in the last days. The first angel's message is a judgment hour message. What is one of the things that Revelation tells us in the judgment in Revelation 11? It points out that God will destroy, who destroy the earth. So, the next huge money to be made in the market, no doubt, is going to be in the explosion of eco-everything. And I've said to my kids, you want to go make your fortune, design the next big eco-something and, invest in the next big eco-something, and, that's the wave of the future. I have a certain cynicism about how everything now is going to be marketed as green this and organic that and eco the other thing. But at the same time, if we as Christians say that we need to recover and restore respect for the character, the authority, the identity of the Creator, surely we should be morally aware and engaged in issues of preserving planet Earth. Now, there is another Christian philosophy regarding the planet. I remember it being publicly reflected in the speeches and policies of Ronald Reagan's Interior Secretary, James Watt. James Watt was probably Pentecostal, but he was certainly a believer in the popular rapture theories that I think Tim is going to talk about this afternoon. And he believed that Christ was going to come very soon, and therefore it was perfectly fine to drill for oil off the coast of California, and it didn't matter how much we spilled and polluted the waters and how much tar washed up on the beautiful beaches of Santa Barbara, because after all, this planet was going to burn anyway very, very soon, and so we might as well exploit it and rape it while we have the chance. Well, that was a Christian perspective on finance and the environment. Let's exploit the planet and its resources and make as much money as we can, because Christ is coming soon and we'll destroy it anyway. So it doesn't matter if we destroy the earth. I dare say that's really not a very mature and high level of moral Christian ethical analysis. And I hope you would agree. Now, it's relatively easy for me to stand up here and say, yes, we ought to be ecologically responsible, and we ought to be aware of how we impact the environment. But on the other hand, I'll be the first to confess, I don't have any particular expertise on the application of those principles. You know, California, we have a very good system of recycling. So yes, of course, we recycle. We're in drought conditions. So yes, of course, we're very concerned about our water use and conserving water. I'm not an expert on how do we implement those values. So I don't want to stand up here and try to tell you, you know, these are the three things or the five things or the seven things that you ought to do. These are things that we will all have to study out for ourselves and see what makes sense within our own families, our own lifestyles, our own church. How do we implement these values? One of the things that... I think Adventism has attracted historically are those who appreciate a rules-based religion. And there are some of us who, by temperament, are very comfortable with being told, here's the structure of religion, here are the rules, this is how you're supposed to live, and just do this. And we're very happy with that kind of structure, and as long as we know what the rules are, you know, we feel well adjusted and content and all the rest. And I don't mean to deride that in any sense. We all have different temperaments. I do think the Bible is far more about the principles than it is about the rules. And it's much harder to live by principles than it is to live by rules. Rules are much easier until you get into a situation, of course, where the rules conflict. I was commenting last night that I saw a Jewish person driven out of the church because of a Sabbath school discussion about the ethics of the hypothetical where the Gestapo knocks on the door and asks the homeowner if there are any Jews being hidden, which there are. And the discussion was, well, of course, the homeowner has to tell the truth there and sacrifice. Well, you see, there's an ethical dilemma there. Lie and violate one commandment in order to preserve life and avoid the murder of innocents, another commandment? Well, the discussion in that Sabbath school class drove away this Jewish person and may have seriously interfered with her prospects for salvation because of what it said about God. When they said, well, of course you have to tell the truth. That's kind of a rigid adherence to rules. You've got two rules now, and they seem conflict. Well, then you get confusion. But then you really have to look at the principles. So what I'm talking about this morning are principles. If we worship the Creator of heaven and the earth, and if we believe that all creation reflects beautiful truth about the character of the Creator, then don't we want to preserve the creation and preserve as much as we can its reflection in its beauty of the character of the Creator? Don't we have respect? And so what I'm arguing for is this principle of respect for God's creation. How we manifest that respect, we're going to have to figure out how to apply that principle. But I see this in Revelation 11, where judgment is determined on those who destroy the planet. I will destroy it. So, you know, when it comes to the economy, one of the consequences of our economic choices is the impact that those choices have on the environment. Another one of the consequences of our economic choices is the impact that it has on workers in many countries who are producing the products that we are consuming and living in luxury and self-indulgence. We are making economic choices. So I'm sorry if our presentation this morning is not solving the problems of the global meltdown and how greed has led to all of these problems and how we get out of them. It's much more personal than that, because few of us are sitting, you know, in key positions in financial institutions making decisions that affect the global economy. But all of us are making decisions about what we buy, what kind of cars we drive, what kind of homes we live in, what kind of clothes we're going to wear, and how many of everything we're going to buy. And so maybe we can't be responsible for what's happening at the global level, but if we're going to derive any spiritual lessons out of what's happened, we have to start applying them to ourselves, don't we? So let's now take a look at Revelation 18. Revelation 18 is a chapter that is easy to read quickly and skim over, and maybe to take for granted. But I think it's a very important chapter, especially as we get closer to the end of time. Because remember that the chapter begins with the repetition, really, of the second angel's message. And it expands on the very message and the mission that God has given to those who are called to prepare the world for the coming of Christ. Is that who we are? Has God called you to prepare the world for the coming of Christ, or at least some small segment of the world? That's who we are, right? That's what it means to be a Seventh-day Adventist. There are many Seventh-day Christians who are not Adventists. And there are quite a few Adventists who are not Seventh-day Adventists. All right. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. The authority of God is an issue in the great controversy, is an issue in the last days. And he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon." Now the emphasis is placed here on the fallenness of Babylon the Great. "She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast." How did she become so spiritual? "For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her." Repetition. So now we have Washington, if you will, and Rome. Washington, all nations, not obviously just Washington, but she is really the ruler of the world, the empress, if you will, of the nations of the world. "The kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and..." Now we have the third part of this threefold union. "And the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living." I told you we'd see that word luxury again and again here in Revelation 18. "The merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living." Preparing for this, I was reading Kevin Phillips' latest book called Bad Money. I really did try to get a little more insight on what's happened to the economy and how things have gotten the way they are. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But one of the things, Kevin Phillips is a very astute observer and student of current affairs. And he makes a connection that I don't think anyone else has really made. And as he develops it to some extent in his book, American Theocracy, where he talks about oil and money and religion. But in Bad Money, he points out that what happened on Wall Street, the Republican coalition that swept into power in the 2000 election included a large constituency of social conservatives who in prior generations would be very hostile to Wall Street. The kind of Southern and Western conservatives who were the backbone of the Republican coalition, who are, you know, the social conservatives, naturally, in past decades, have been really quite hostile to kind of the money grubbers, if you will, in finance and Wall Street. But this time around, there was silence. And when Wall Street overreached and began to create whole market segments that were either underregulated or completely unregulated, there was silence from that whole constituency of religious conservatives that was the backbone of the vote that put the Republicans in power. Well, what Phillips observes, he's got the statistics on the dominance of the prosperity gospel among Christians. And names, and many of the big name preachers are preaching it, not just the likes of Schuller, but Joel Osteen's name was mentioned yesterday, and T.D. Jakes, and many others. And such a large segment of American Christianity now believes that it is God's will for you to be wealthy, and that if you have faith, you will be wealthy. And if you give money to the preacher, you give money to the church, God will bless you. And various forms of the prosperity gospel. That the prosperity gospel is a perfect support for unregulated on Wall Street. Because, of course, it is God's will to make money and to be wealthy. Now, I mean, hopefully you know the story of what happened. And if you don't, we're not going to take a long time this morning to develop it. Obviously, there was a certain amount of personal greed with people speculating and buying homes that they really could not afford on speculation that before the ink was dry and they had moved into the home, it would have gone up $30,000, $50,000 and they could go ahead and flip it and make money and et cetera, and eventually actually be able to have a home that they could afford. And so they were getting loans based on income that was not sufficient to support those loans. And then those bad loans were being packaged, and they were bad loans to begin with, but when they all got packaged, the rating agencies put investment grade ratings on these bonds, and they were securitized and marketed. But even the mortgage part of the market was just a small part of what was happening, because the leverage that was used in one bank insuring another bank and insuring each other with these credit default swaps, when you really look into it, it was mind-boggling. It makes the leverage of Wall Street in 1929 seem like child's play by comparison. And so, yes, when the house of cards started to come tumbling down, there's a huge amount of deleveraging, and there are all of these financial instruments called derivatives where there is no inherent value. And it's all being propped up like a house of cards. And nobody knows what they're really worth. And then the accounting principles say, well, you have to hold them on the books according to what a willing buyer will pay a willing seller, what the actual market value is, but there's no market value anymore because the market has just ground to a dead halt. And so all of these assets that have been valued at literally of dollars overnight are worthless. And the whole thing comes tumbling down, and here we are in this huge mess trying to sort out how to keep the system afloat with the aftermath of unregulated. Now, for many years, when I would talk about the Ten Commandments and their relation to law, and we did the last couple of days, why it's illegitimate for the state to legislate the commandments that pertain to our relation to God and to worship, and what the separation of church and state means, and how I talk about the second table of the law is reflected by and large in the laws of really every society, I would inevitably come to the Tenth Commandment and observe that the modern economy is founded on the violation of the Tenth Commandment. That the modern economy is founded on covetousness. Right? Well, if there is a lesson that we have learned in the last couple of years, it has to be that violation of the Tenth Commandment is not a firm foundation for the modern economy. And now you start to read articles in the editorial pages about the old-fashioned virtues of modesty and thrift and living within your means. And we're told that we're all going to be deleveraging over the next 5 or 6 years. Deleveraging is a term for trying to pay off our credit cards and reduce the debt that is drowning us like a noose around our necks. And so we're all going to have to save more and spend less. It's really not difficult for any of us to conduct public meetings in our towns and remind our friends and neighbors of the lesson of this economy, that we ought to give respect to the Creator and to His law, and that even our economy ought to reflect the principles and the character, and that the mess that we're in was caused by the violation running roughshod over the covetousness on an enormous scale. Not just in Wall Street, but in Main Street. Because the massive amount of debt that has fueled this economy is right here in this room. Just as well as it is anywhere else, isn't it? We're not immune from it. We've all been part of this whole system. And so it's time for us all to go back to the drawing and rethink our own relationship to money, to debt, to our family finances, to our own moral responsibility, far beyond the issues of tithe and stewardship principles. Well, stewardship principles are absolutely vitally important here. So I'm not going to step on Ed's department. Let's keep reading here in Revelation 18. Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." Now, pay her back as she herself has paid back others, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed. As she glorified herself and lived, how? In luxury. Again, we see that word. So give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, "I sit as a queen, I am no widow, and mourning I shall never see," for this reason her plagues will come in a single day: death and mourning and famine. And she will be burned up with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who has judged her. So judgment comes upon Babylon very rapidly in one day. And we'll read here in just a moment, our economic system comes crashing down. But notice this call to come out of Babylon. come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins. We've often thought of Babylon in terms primarily of spiritual, of the false doctrines that have been absorbed into various strains of Christianity. And we thought about the need to come into pure doctrine and a worship of the Creator. And that's absolutely critically important. That's certainly true. But the Babylon that's being described here more fully in Revelation is a Babylon that has a religious power allied with both government and finance. You have the political powers, the economic system, and the religious system all united together. Do you see that? Do we need to give more thought to what it means to come out of Babylon? What does it mean to come out of Babylon when Babylon is so closely aligned with the political and economic structures? Do we need to rethink how morality and spirituality to money and to our participation? Those of the earth who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her. They will stand far off. So they, you know, it's described here that the kings of the earth have become so intimate with both the religious and economic powers, living in luxury with Babylon, with the religious power, described as sexual immorality. That's how intimate and involved they have become. And now, when it collapses, you see the kings of the earth want to back away. It says they will stand far off. So there's an attempt at a divorce, if you will, a repudiation. They now are pictured as seeking to avoid the fate of Babylon by standing far off in fear of her torment, not wanting to suffer the same fate. And they say, "Alas, alas, you great city, you mighty city Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore, cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots and slaves," that is, human souls. I think it was Dr. Luke who said that if all that Jesus had done and said were put in books, the world... Are there unnecessary words in the Bible? Are there things that are, you know, duly repetitive or redundant? Or that was a mouthful I just read, wasn't it? It just went on and on and on about all kinds of merchandise, didn't it? Why? Yeah, I think he is trying to get a point across. It is all coming crashing down. And maybe, you know, if we're going to come out of Babylon, maybe we have to rethink our relationship to the consumer culture as part of coming out of Babylon. Now, there's a specific angle, there's a specific aspect of this that the Adventist Church has been involved with. The last thing that's said here is about trading in the bodies and souls of men. And I don't know if you're aware that slavery today is probably a larger problem in the world than it has ever. And the worldwide figures on human trafficking are very difficult to get accurately. But conservatively, it's estimated that about 1 million, mostly women and children, especially underage women, are trafficked for the sex trade, for the drug trade, in other kinds of criminal conspiracies, in sweatshops and what have you, and at least 20,000 here in the United States. every year. And so in our public affairs ministry, both in Washington, D.C., and in certainly in the Pacific Union, we have participated in efforts to strengthen laws against human trafficking. And certainly your support of our work with the North American Religious Liberty Association, awareness of these issues, I think, is certainly welcome and appropriate. Human trafficking, you know, harkens back to our abolitionist days and our opposition to slavery of African Americans in this country. It's an enormous problem. And what we find is that if anything in this country, if anybody's arrested, it's the victims of human trafficking who are being used in illegal endeavors such as prostitution or drug trade. They may be arrested and deported. The traffickers themselves are rarely apprehended. So this is a big problem. It's a problem right here in our own states, in our own nation, and it's a problem around the world. Verse 14, the fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your delicacies and all your splendors are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants, we see the merchants again, the merchants of these wares, who gained wealth from her, will stand far off. So first we saw the kings of the earth wanting to distance themselves from Babylon. Now we see the merchants wanting to stand afar off, to distance themselves from Babylon. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off, in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas for the great city, they cry, that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels, and with pearls. For in a single hour, all this wealth has been laid. Well, there we have the future of our 401ks and our Social Security accounts and our medical benefits. It's all going down the tubes, folks. And we can count on that. And everything that we've got is going to burn up, Peter said. So we need to gain some perspective, because it's so easy to become emotionally invested and attached and comfortable to what we have and to the life that we have in this life. And all shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors and all whose trade is on the sea stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city was like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, alas, alas, for the great city where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth. For in a single hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, so will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will be found no more. And the sound of harpists and musicians, of flute players and trumpeters, will be heard in you no more. And a craftsman of any craft will be found in you no more. And the sound of the mill will be heard in you no more, and the light of a lamp will shine in you no more, and the voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more. For your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth. And so I think that this takes us back where we began, with the admonition of Peter. What manner of persons ought we to be in holiness and godliness as we both look for and hasten the coming of the day of Christ? I think very simply, whatever economic shocks we may be in for in the run-up to the close of probation, in the run-up to the final crisis, the ultimate collapse comes after. And I think that we have a golden opportunity, with everyone's attention focused on economic issues and on the economic problems, we have a golden opportunity with our evangelism to give some straight talk to our neighbors. Let our evangelistic meetings not be business as usual, but let's just tell it straight. You know, I do a lot of talk radio, and I've interacted with a lot of people in the interfaith community, and I will tell you, there is already so many winds of doctrine blowing that most Christians these days are no longer as judgmental as they once were about people who hold differing doctrinal beliefs. Seventh-day Adventists have been almost paranoid about how our beliefs are how other Christians relate to what we believe. We've been very hesitant about things like the doctrine of the judgment, the pre-Advent judgment. We're always so worried about what people will think about our doctrines. Folks, anyone these days who is, you know, been in the Christian world for any length of time and has had any involvement in anything to do with more than just their own little congregation, they've been exposed to so many different doctrines that a Seventh-day Adventist with our doctrines, it's no big deal. We're just another Christian. They don't care that we have some differing beliefs. We don't need to be fearful or paranoid or worried about what people will think of us as Christians because we have some doctrines and beliefs that differ from what they have. To simply invite the community and stand up and tell it like it is. Yes, this world is going to burn up. Everything you've got is going to burn up. There will be, ultimately, a financial collapse. But no, we don't know when, you know, how quickly it will come. And what we're experiencing now, we may very well muddle through, or it may get worse. But we just don't know. We just don't know. And the Bible doesn't tell us. And it's very important that we stick to what the Bible tells us and that we share it with our communities and that we tell it straight. We don't need to beat around the bush. We don't need to be embarrassed. We have been called for such as this. And we have been called to very graciously invite the people in our communities to come out of the confusion that is Babylon. And that confusion is profound. That confusion is both a confusion of religion and politics, and it's a confusion of religion and economics. And we see the confused doctrine I alluded to you earlier with the prosperity gospel. But let's face it, even in America today, even those who do not ascribe to the prosperity gospel, Christianity is gung-ho on capitalism. It goes back really to our Puritan roots, doesn't it? We are absolutely gung-ho on the free market and on capitalism and on making money. This is part of the Protestant work ethic. And so there is a certain confusion between religion and the economy, between religion and politics, and all these things are mixed up together. And God is calling us to come out, to come apart, not after Babylon falls, the kings of the earth want to stand apart, and the merchants of the earth want to stand apart, but the time to stand apart from Babylon is before, is now, isn't it? Now's the time to stand apart and to call people to stand apart from Babylon while we still can. Now, I want to close with one thought. Many of us have experienced economic uncertainty. We have experienced bankruptcies and foreclosures within our churches. We've experienced people losing their jobs, losing their homes, stresses on marriages. We've all been suffered the same way that others have. In the Lord's Prayer, Jesus taught us to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread." Jesus didn't promise us that we would pay tomorrow's bills today, that we would be able to buy tomorrow's food today. But He has promised us the faith, the courage, the resources. Some of us may have to learn to live that way sooner. Eventually, we will all have to learn to rely upon what God will provide for us as we hang on to Christ. Let's pray. Father in heaven, as Jesus taught us, we ask You today for faith for today, for grace for today to live for You, for ears today to hear what Your Spirit is saying to us today. Thank You for the privilege that we have to know You. And Lord, may we understand better how to fully come out of Babylon today and how to champion the identity, the character, the authority of You as our Creator today. And Jesus, we depart this place after the Sabbath. We go home and continue to minister in our own. Lord, may Your Spirit inspire and bless us. In Christ's name.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2009. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.